Hello and welcome to Let Them Eat Cake. This will be episode 22. I am Jack. My co-hosts are John and Ace. And this week we'll be covering what, John?
This week we're going to be doing another collaboration with Militant Wire, focused on political literacy of South Asia. There's a lot of elections coming up this year, and because of the closeness of China and Taiwan and how important that conflict is, it's important to understand and contextualize the area. So it's a really, what do they call it? It's you say it for like an intro.
Crash course?
Crash course. Yeah. It's a crash course on South Asian politics. Before we get into the episode, let's go over a few topics that are in today's headlines. I think a lot of people are freaking out about the drone collision in Ukraine. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about it?
As far as we can tell, the entire incident was accidental, the collision. However, from what we can tell from reports, from news stories, from everything that we can gather, the Russian Sukhoi jets were harassing the drone for about 30 to 40 minutes. So we don't actually know what the pattern that the drone was taking was. Russia claims that it was directly going towards Russian borders or Russian airspace. Whether that's Crimea or the Russian Federation, we don't actually know. It's all very vague. America claims that it was because Russia was doing basically just doing dumb shit. Like, that's the long and the short of it. They were pretty much just being reckless around this drone. We saw reports that fuel was being dumped on the drones, which is when the collision happened. The problem here is Russia is going to use this to ramp up aggression against drones, I think. That's, again, form your own opinion on that. I don't care, really. Like, at the end of the day, America's going to be there supplying support and information to Kiev, and that's the long and the short of it. This is, at the end of the day, an information war, and an information war requires you to be forever vigilant about the information coming from both sides. So I'm not going to speculate, but these types of conflicts, these types of engagements are not uncommon for Russia. Russia often bullies people and harasses them and runs into them. It's happened in Syria to US forces, which will lead us into our next topic.
Yeah, so recently in the city of Idlib, there was rallies commemorating the anniversary of the Syrian Revolution, which now has been going on for 12 years. And I guess it just kind of goes to show you that for most people who kind of mildly follow the news, Syria is kind of like a frozen conflict. It's a dead conflict. Like, it's all said and done. It's a bad place. It's a wasteland. But for a lot of these people who have lived through it in northern Syria, the sentiment of the revolution is still very much alive. And I think so long as that sentiment is alive, is people, you know, troops will continue to get moved around. Insurgent groups and militant groups will continue to challenge the Syrian government and vice versa.
It's also the anniversary of a really important internationalist who died in Kurdistan, Anna Campbell. She's one of the probably the most famous internationalist who went to Kurdistan.
That's the British lady, right?
Yes, exactly. Well, the most important internationalist who died in the Rojava Revolution section of the Syrian war. So it's a really important day through all of northern Syria for revolutionaries.
We just used the term frozen conflict. Quite recently, the U.S. has announced that they will do a kind of a look into, probe into Yemen, into possible war crimes that have been committed by the Saudi government there. And the reason this concerns the U.S. is because they did it using weapons supplied to them by the U.S. So again, this could derail arm sales to Saudi Arabia if the U.S. decides it kind of wants to take a more humanitarian stance towards the Saudi government and them using weapons that have been sold to them to commit war crimes in Yemen, matter of factly. And it also comes at a pretty striking timing, as there has been this newfound like diplomacy between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and China is also involved in that as well, with a gas deal between China and Saudi Arabia. So again, this is kind of, it's like, wow, while it is a good step, it is also kind of a bargaining chip for the United States in case they feel like Saudi Arabia might be acting a little too out of line in regards to their relations with China and Iran.
The thing is that I don't think the United States really cares about Saudi Arabia committing the war crimes. They wouldn't have sold them the weapons if they really cared. They wouldn't have, you know, that everyone knows how screwed up that war was. They literally went in and Biden told them straight up, like, oh, don't worry, we're going to make sure that you don't take heat for that journalist you butchered, you know? So, like, the American government is, like, actively covering for them already. But what's really important about Saudi Arabia that people don't understand is their control of the information space. MBS, this was his main thing, is that he wanted to control the information space. Their main investor in Twitter, they basically own Twitter. Like, we can say Elon Musk is, like, the shareholder lead or whatever, but like he's really answering to the Saudi government at this point in a lot of different ways, and their ability to control information is something that is completely underlooked. There was just this girl, Eden Knight. She came over to this country legally on a visa. Her father is involved with the Saudi government. And she came to this country because she's trans. So her visa expired and her parents were holding her passport. So she was kind of in a position where a lot of illegals are, where they came in on a proper visa and, like, you know, someone might be blackmailing them. A lot of times jobs are blackmailing these people, but they hired these people. Basically, they were this entire plot to traffic her back to Saudi Arabia. And if you just go onto Twitter and you just type in her name, Eden Knight, you can read about it yourself. And she basically left her entire story on why she killed herself and then did it immediately after it was confirmed, misgendering her. But she was basically forced into a position by fixers because she didn't have legal paperwork. And she ended up going back to Saudi Arabia, and then a month later, she killed herself. And the Saudi government, because they're involved with this girl being, you know, taken out of the country and this whole plot, have actually been trying to downplay it. And for a while, it wasn't getting any coverage until, like, maybe today people started covering it. So even the smallest things are being interfered with by the Saudi government. And as far as, like, America's role goes, when it comes to what tolerance is, it's a very specific thing. And it's the thing is tolerance is just not caring what other people do. You don't really have to like it. You just mind your own business. That's what tolerance is. All right. And that's what needs to happen in America. Like, if you don't like, you know, certain things and certain types of people, that's fine. All right. Nobody's telling you have to change, and nobody's telling cultures that come here that they have to change. But when it comes to America, we influence the culture of the world. And currently, right now, with our legislation, we're giving justice to regimes like Saudi Arabia, justice to regimes like the Taliban, you know, all these persecutions of women and LGBT throughout the world get justified by our actions. On that note, protect trans kids. If you have a gun, check out your local direct action folks, and just be a body for these protests. Because we just saw literal the skinheads came back, you know, since the first time since Charlottesville, and actual, like, face tattooed Nazis with flags, gun on the hip. So definitely get out there and just be a body. Even if you don't understand people, if you have a gun, you already have something in common with most of these people, and you can just talk about that with them and get to know them. It's probably a great place to start. And
Armed minorities are harder to oppress.
On that very depressing note, let's start our very regular political literacy interview.
We have a weapon more powerful than the British Empire, and that weapon is our refusal to bow to any order but our own, any institution but our own.
Amade, I'm a researcher mainly focused on South and Southeast Asia, mainly security and politics.
So we have a lot of elections coming up this year in Asia. So that's why we brought you on to talk about. What do you think is the most important election going on in that area?
Personally, I think Timor-Leste is one of the most critical elections out of all of them, even though it might be, you know, not many people know about it, but Timor-Leste is a country that is somewhat at a crossroads. Since it got independence in 2002, all the leaders have been, you know, the former independence heroes, and it's a back and forth between two parties. And since 2017, 2018, like, the political deadlock between these two rival parties became so bad, like, the government hasn't been able to function. And because of Indonesia's occupation, Timor has a very young population. The voting age is 17, and, you know, 70% of the population is less than 35 years old. There's not a lot of economic opportunities there. They have oil that's part of the oil fund, but that's a bit of a resource curse. And, there's a lot of concern about youth unemployment, and one of Timor's biggest security threats is, you know, this youth unemployment, because they join martial arts gangs. And in the last 6 months in Dili, in the capital, there's been, you know, this uptick of martial art gang violence. And there's concerns about that, you know, disrupting the elections. And they will be involved in the elections. So there's a lot going on for Timor-Leste at the moment. And
Wasn't there an election last year?
Yeah, so that was a presidential election. And the guy who's become president, Jose Damas Horta, he was a former, he won the Nobel Peace Prize. He was an activist. He used to rally for Timor-Leste overseas, like during Indonesia's occupation. And he has been a former leader. He came back last year, and he's been trying to break the deadlock between these two parties, the Fretland Party and the National Congress for Timorese Reconstruction. He's hoping that, you know, things stabilize a little bit, but I don't know. It doesn't seem that great. Yeah, that's him.
Is East Timor is the one where the oil field is contested by Australia, right?
Yeah, the Greater Sunrise thing. That was, I think you've heard of Witness K and, you know, the spying scandal, if you did. But in 2002, Australia and Timor were negotiating the Timor Gap Treaty. You know, where to demarcate their boundary between in the Timor Sea, because there's a lot of oil and gas over there. And there's a project there called the Greater Sunrise Project. And Australia's Secret Service, they were spying on Timorese officials, including the Prime Minister. They had bugged the Prime Minister's office. And that helped Australia gain the upper hand in negotiations. And they came out with a Timor Sea treaty that was very unfair to Timor. Right. And then in 2011, someone who was spying from the Australian Secret Service, he's called Witness K. They haven't released his name yet. His case just came out last year. But he basically said that they had been spying, and this caused like this massive diplomatic fallout between Australia and Timor-Leste, and Timor threatened to take them to like international arbitration. And then they eventually renegotiated the Greater Sunrise Project. And right now there's tensions over this Greater Sunrise Project because Timor is running out of oil, right? So this is one of the projects that, you know, will help fund the government in the future. And Australia wants, the company that's doing this for Australia is called Woodside. It wants the gas to be shipped, like piped to Darwin in Australia. And it said it would be cheaper and more feasible. But there was an independent study that came out last year that said, you know, it's actually not true. Like, there will be more initial costs of setting up a plant in Timor, but in the long term, like, the project cost will not be that. So this is causing more controversy because, you know, given the history of Australia involving, like, is negotiations over this. So, like, José de Mas Horta and likely the next prime minister, who's going to be Zenana Gusmão, they're very adamant that, you know, the gas comes to Timor. So that's a big thing.
Yeah, yeah. And it should. And fucking, there's so much dodgy shit that ASIO does and nobody cares.
Yeah.
Because for whatever reason, I've said this on here before, I think, but like, Australians just have this apathetic thing where they don't care. It's like, as long as they're happy and they're comfortable and they can drink beer and watch footy, it's fine. And it's all of this sort of stuff. People should be angry about this. People shouldn't be happy that the Australian government is fucking with people internationally, and nobody cares. And the government just does it. Nobody says anything. Both governments, no matter who's in control.
Is there any other competing powers in this area?
Just China.
Yeah, it's...
Maybe India if they wanted to, but they don't really...
Not really. They don't project. No. It's mainly being a playground between China and the West.
Mm. So. Although, maybe Japan, but I don't even think Japan's going to do anything because America's there.
Yeah.
So, I don't think Japan's even going to bother doing anything. Even though they are doing projects in South Asia between... Yeah. Was it Thailand and Vietnam?
I think they're building
Infrastructure, yeah. Which is good because it competes against China, and that's what we need. Especially countering this bloody Belt and Road thing, which I don't know if you know about this, but the Victorian Premier almost sold Victoria's infrastructure to the Belt and Road Initiative.
I didn't know it was in Australia. Like,
yeah, it was Victoria. Like, yeah. Yep, okay. Daniel Andrews signed a deal, or it wasn't a deal, he signed a promise, or like one of those sort of de facto deals that's not really a deal, and then magically got a trip to China. How funny. Ooh, interesting. it's actually really funny. You would think that the opposition party would try and shoot it down, but it was actually the Federal Labor Party that was like, you are not selling Victoria's infrastructure to China. And they shot it down. And now they're over in China making deals with them. So, is East Timor relevant to anyone else other than itself and Australia and Indonesia? Is there anyone else that really cares about what it does?
Unfortunately, the answer to that is no. It's pretty much been left alone. Countries will like feign an interest, and you know, when the elections come, everyone will say, oh, look at the elections, and Timor is a democracy, and like they'll congratulate them and congratulate the incoming prime minister. They'll make statements, oh, we'll have good relations and all that. But at the end of the day, because Australia runs a lot of the resource projects over there, Australian companies, like the oil and gas, because they have the expertise, right? And Timor wants some, they want, more say in what they do. So like China has been trying to flirt over there too, and the US does help them in terms of the military a little bit, in terms of training, building infrastructure. But yeah, Timor is a very like economically very weak, it's very dependent, you know, so even for medicines and stuff like that, the UN is sending medicines and things like that. So it's a very new country, right? And Indonesia occupation completely destroyed it, and didn't let it grow. So
it like has said, a fairly... great freedom score, though.
Yeah, their elections have been, like, the presidential election last year was quite open, free and fair. And
where did they
in
lose
2006,
points?
In 2000, in the early, so 2002 is when Timor became independent. From about 2002 to 2006, there was a lot of political turmoil. There was like a kind of coup also, attempted coup. And Ramos Horta, who was the president at that time, there was an assassination attempt on him also around 2008. So like over the last few years, it has, you know, stabilized a lot more. And people had thought that their last year's elections would be violent, but they were not. Not at all. There's some concerns about this because this is a parliamentary election, and you know, it's the general election, and there's more youth mobilization for this kind of thing.
So where it looks like it loses the most points is corruption and the legal system.
Yeah.
And so that looks like mainly what it is that type of thing.
But yeah, corruption.
Speaking of fair elections, one of my favorite countries to politically follow because it's impossible is Pakistan, who also are having important elections coming up. So why don't we get into them for a little bit and talk about what happened to lead to these elections that will be coming up.
Right. So Pakistan's elections are supposed to, general elections are supposed to happen by October. I mean, Pakistan over the last few years has just been characterized between the political turmoil between Imran Khan on one side and the establishment and government on the other side. These parties like the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz or the Pakistan People's Party. So these are two sides. In April last year, Imran Khan was ousted by a no confidence motion. And since then, he's tried to force early elections on the government. He's tried to organize protest movements to force early elections, but that didn't work out. He's dissolved the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and Punjab assemblies in January, which is party controlled. So that is going to force provincial elections. I mean, there's a lot that goes on between like Imran Khan and these guys, but while this political mess is happening, you know, you guys have talked about the rise of terrorism there. You had someone from Fatah, I think, or KP talking on your show. So there's this rise of terrorism, right? And the main thing is Pakistan's economy, which has really been, even before COVID, it was in a very bad state. Like, there's very low foreign direct investment. There's a lot of debt. There's low foreign reserves. There's a lot of inflation. Right now, the IMF said that it would not agree to some of the, like, the IMF and Pakistan have not reached another bailout deal. So, you know, it's just been in this constantly.
A lot of natural disasters occurred recently as well.
Yeah, the flooding last year also, that was, it disrupted economic activity. It cost like billions in losses, and it also delayed the elections, the local elections and stuff. So all this has been going on, and, you know, the government and the military, they're trying to hold elections like when they don't want early elections because they're a bit concerned that Imran Khan still has popularity. Because when you see the election results over the last year for by-elections and some of the assemblies, like Imran Khan's party wins quite a lot and the government parties aren't doing that well. The recent Karachi by-elections, there was a lot of allegations of rigging. There's a lot of things going on, you know.
According to Imran Khan, the United States ousted him. And he has a folded piece of paper just like the birth certificate, you know. To prove it all, that he won't unfold.
Yeah, so the no confidence motion against him was apparently a foreign conspiracy and all. But there's last year what came out is how they were planning it. Also, there's some proof of how they had tried to, you know, frame it as a foreign conspiracy. But Imran Khan, he's been very anti-West. He's the one who said, like, you know, the Afghan Taliban's our neighbor. This is great now. He's one of them. Like he's trying to portray himself as
he literally helped the Taliban take over.
He's trying to portray himself as like the champion of Islam, you know, like Erdogan or kind of thing, but it hasn't gone like that, I feel. When he was in power, like provincial authorities in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa did nothing. And Imran Khan even had a plan, like, let's resettle the TTP, the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. And, yeah, I don't even know what to say to that. But he's blaming now it's funny how he's blaming the terrorism on the current government, even though, like, a lot of it is on him and just Pakistan's counterterrorism policies in the last 10, 20 years.
Well, there's always the question of who actually runs Pakistan.
Yeah. There's too many interests, right? I mean, even with the politics, even within the military, you have the ISI, you have different generals, you have different interests, and even within the politicians, like, Pakistan's very corrupt, and is the political elite who hold everything. So, yeah, Imran Khan is also corrupt. He's also caught up in a corruption case, you know, so It's, I mean, it's like most of the world, right? The elite don't care about
the
people.
I don't know. It's. I see the benefits of this, but I also like. I also see it being exploited a lot. Is like when there's not set election dates.
Yeah.
And like when you can like, okay, it's cool that you can be able to like force an election and like because if somebody's like really really bad, but at the same time. I've seen it just exploited by dictators where they'll be like, they'll snap an election when they know that they're going to have an advantage and be like, haha, fuck you. And that's how their democracy works. And they use democracy as a weapon to enforce their rule.
Yeah. And that's interesting that you brought it up because not to defend Imran Khan, but the current government, it's supposed to hold, you know, the Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and Punjab assembly elections within 60 or 90 days after the assembly is dissolved as per the constitution. But right now it's saying, you know, there's a lot of security concerns and the interior ministry has said that, you know, they cannot guarantee safety for elections because security forces are so busy, like in anti-militancy that they can't be stretched out for this. So now we're getting to a point where the elections may not happen, like the provincial elections may not happen as per the constitution. So we're getting into like a gray area where, you know, Imran Khan could challenge the government and bring in the Supreme Court if he doesn't get disqualified, you know. So also the justification of delaying like the general elections for security or delaying provincial elections for security, that's, yeah, it's kind of an emergency in that kind of sense, you know. So
Who recently delayed elections because of security and it caused like basically a was that Myanmar?
Yeah.
It was Myanmar? I'm pretty sure that's next on the list anyway.
Yeah, that is.
It is not. It is fifth on the list, but...
No, we can jump to that.
Because, like, how do you have elections there?
I mean, this is one of the places, like, elections doesn't matter anyway, even if they hold them, right? It's not like most of the people will participate in the process. It's just a farce for the military to show themselves, oh, look, we've held elections. Pat yourself on the back kind of thing, and tell the international community that it's one of those like elections that don't matter. But yeah, they extended it because of the state of emergency. They extended the state of emergency and they said it's because of insecurity. But I mean, that insecurity is just going to increase, right? Myanmar is not getting any more stable. The military, it's not so easy for the EAOs and PDFs and the resistance. It is going to be drawn out, but the military's... It is strong, but it's losing slowly, I feel.
In a situation like this, would not participating in democracy be a bigger statement than participating? I love this question, by the way.
Yeah, definitely. So in Myanmar, there's a lot of strikes that happen, the civil strikes. And, you know, recently there was some anniversary and what people did was just silent strikes and, you know, people just staying indoors instead. That video, I remember seeing that on the 1st of February 2021. Yeah, the song that is playing on that video is actually an Indonesian song about, you know, it's against the police kind of, so it was quite ironic when this whole thing was happening. But yeah, Ampun Bang Jago.
So can Aung San Suu Kyi even participate in elections? Is that even going to be a possibility? Is there even an opposition that can run at this point? Or is this just like Belarus 2.0?
I think it's like that because Aung San Suu Kyi, her party, the National League of Democracy, will not participate in the elections. So, like, everyone views the elections as illegitimate, so it's not, you know.
You say National League of Democracy.
For democracy, yeah.
That sounds like the Democratic Republic of Korea.
I mean, you know, people have this thing about like Aung San Suu Kyi before like the whole Rohingya tarnished her image. Like people were like, she's a champion for freedom and all of that. But if you actually see like the NLD and Aung San Suu Kyi since the 90s, they aren't like very democratic. They've just been championed like that. Like she would hold a lot of control. And, you know, even when the NLD was in power, what a lot of ethnic communities didn't like is that centrally the chief minister of each state was chosen without taking into account, you know, the local communities in each of the ethnic
states. Sounds like Australia.
Yeah. So, I mean, the NLD, yeah, like people now are, you know, as NLD is the face of, you know, democracy in Myanmar and all, but it has a lot of internal issues, and Aung San Suu Kyi is not like the democratic champion that people would say she is.
Yeah, it's often the case like that. Talking about that, is it more like the parties select the leaders, or is it like just central government picks
parties
regardless? You get what I'm saying.
Yeah, so I mean, so it's really been the last two elections, 2015 and the last one in 2020. It's just been NLD versus the government party. And NLD has won a majority in both. In 2020, they won a super majority. You know, so it's just them. There's a couple like smaller parties that come on like the provincial scale, but on a national level, it's pretty much the NLD versus the Union Solidarity and Development Party, which is the military's political wheel.
Okay.
Wasn't she arrested for having a walkie-talkie?
Yeah, I mean, they keep putting charges on her, like. She was in house arrest during the 90s and late 80s, 90s at that time also. Yeah, they just put like whatever charge they can put on her. The military had actually introduced this rule that directly blocked her from being the head of state, because they said that anyone with a foreign, like as per the 2008 constitution, which is very problematic, in that they put like anyone with a foreign spouse cannot be a head of state, and she's married to like a British citizen. So that's why she had to become like the state counselor, which became another controversy in itself. Can't be the leader as per the constitution also.
If we're looking at the elections happening or not happening, would it be a bigger deal? And I'm not just even internally, but externally, just diplomatically, would it be an issue? Would people care if there was no elections? Or would they just rather screen it just like how every dictator does and have sham elections and just, you know, take 90% of the vote? Like, what's going to be the better path for the military that's obviously going to stay in power?
Yeah. See, that's an interesting question when it comes to Myanmar, because if you go to Myanmar's history, it has been, you know, very isolated at times because of the military, and they don't care as long as, you know, they're in power over there making money. They don't care so much about international perceptions. Like ASEAN is trying a lot with Indonesia being the chair this year to, you know, try to get a consensus on Myanmar. But for the military, I don't think they care about perception to, you know, outsiders that much, or even their own people, because otherwise they wouldn't.
I think
they
have China backing them anyway, so.
That's not so clear cut as it is, because when the NLD was in power, Aung San Suu Kyi, like China cozied up with her, because China basically just wants its China Myanmar economic corridor, all those projects,
because
China
has opium. Billions.
Not that. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of crime and drugs and all of that, but the China-Myanmar economic corridor basically allows China access to the Indian Ocean without having to go through the South China Sea. So they're building a lot of like railroads, infrastructure, ports, dams along the way, and it's similar to Pakistan, you know, where they're trying to circumvent India and go on the western side of the Indian Ocean. So they're trying to get, it's their string of pearls kind of BRI project. So Myanmar is very important in that sense. So China wants stability over there. That's not to say that, you know, it supports the Myanmar government, because the military has been critical, because China in the past would support the ethnic armed organizations, right? They're all armed with Chinese weapons. All those come from China. So, you know, it's not so clear cut to say that China backs them. China just wants its interests, and it will go with whoever is in the position at that moment.
I mean, at the given opportunity, they would take Myanmar and not look back. Like,
yep.
It's as simple as that.
Yep.
How long has the military been in control now?
Since Myanmar gained independence in like the late 40s, early 50s. There was a few years, and the military was in power till from the 1950s, I think, till about 2011. 2015 was like the first proper open elections. So, yeah, it's just been a country that, you know.
Yeah, my old boss was like there when it was going on, when the elections were going on, and he's like seen her speak and stuff when she, like before the, you know, genocide.
Yeah.
But they have some interesting neighbors down there that are also having elections this year.
Yeah.
We have both Cambodia and Thailand. What do we want to dive into first?
Oh, whichever one you guys feel. I will just say about Myanmar, the military thinks of itself as like the parent of the country. And, you know, like all Myanmarese are its kids and it has to take care. And, you know, it has this kind of attitude and like, it's a very, yeah, it's not a state relationship kind of thing. Anyway, Thailand or Cambodia?
Thailand. Which one has the king that like has a puppy and wears bondage gear out?
That's Thailand.
All right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think there's the protest there against the king. So I'm confused how much power that the government has with the king. And, you know, I know that there's things like you have to like I heard stories like going to the movie theater, like you have to basically pledge allegiance to the king before watching movies or something. I've heard all kinds of stuff like that.
So in Thailand, the monarchy is pretty much a sacred institution that is looked up, you know, by a lot of people with respect. Like they'll prostrate themselves willingly, a lot of people, in front of the king. It's also one of the places with like the strictest lèse majesté laws, lèse majesté. You know, you can get 15 years in jail for perceived insults to the king. There's not really a lot of discussion about what you... You can't really have a lot of discussion or open debate about the monarchy's role. Yeah, see, that picture, if you're seeing that in Thailand, you could be jailed for that. People have been jailed for sharing, like, BBC biographies about him and, you know, like, things that portray him in a negative light. There's a journalist, Andrew McGregor Marshall. He's a very controversial guy, but he's written a lot against the king, and he's basically banned from Thailand. But yeah, Thailand, so it has been a monarchy for, I don't know, nearly 1,000 years. If it has been, you know, like the kingdom of Siam, there's been 4 or 5 different kingdoms until its modern history. And until 1932, it was a constitutional monarchy. Until 1932, it was an absolute monarchy. And then, you know, it became a constitutional monarchy. And since 1932 till now, there's been like this push and pull with people trying to be more democratic, but the conservative elite establishment, they're trying to, you know.
Is a dog the chief of the Air Force?
It was. It's dead now.
Air Marshal Fufu, yeah.
That is amazing.
It was just a honorific title kind of thing. Yeah, that was her. But... yeah.
I think they had a chance to basically abolish the monarchy, but they actually really liked the last king, is kind of what I've heard.
Yeah, so the last king, he was very popular, and he played a very stabilizing role in Thailand's contemporary history. So since 1932, it became a constitutional monarchy, and since then there's been, what, like, maybe 13 successful coups, and maybe like 9 or 10 unsuccessful coups. So during this period, and they've had like maybe 29, 30 prime ministers in, you know, 70, 80 years, which is pretty crazy. So the king had played quite the stabilizing role in that sense. And, you know, when things got too much, like he would be consulted and he would direct the government. And
is this the right guy?
Bhumibol. Yeah, that's him younger. Yeah. So he was... very well liked and very popular, but he died in 2016, and his son is not on the same stature that he is. So one of the, you mentioned the, you know, pro-democracy kind of protests and all, those are pretty much dead now. But what they want is they want Thailand to relook its relationship that the state has with the monarchy and how entrenched the monarchy is and everything and all. They want a more open democratic thing. They want a new constitution also. But the movement is pretty much dead. Like this, the elections that are coming, there's no one to represent the pro-democratic. There is one party, but that's not going to win much. This is mainly going to be a fight between like the loyalists, different loyalists of the king and all the kingsmen and the conservatives and all of them, and one main opposition party, the Pu'atai party.
So what actual power do the elections actually have? I'm not sure if you answered that because I've been typing, yeah. So I missed some stuff.
Power that the election, I mean, these are the general elections. They are going to be free and fair. This will set like the government for the next 5 years, right? And it comes at a time when Thailand's trying to recover from COVID and there's a lot of those issues. It is a key election. It's not going to be something that's, you know, super rigged or anything. It's not going to be like a farce that Myanmar is. It will be like an open democratic elections. And this is the first test, you know, for the government. In 2014 was the last coup. And then that military government from the coup basically entrenched themselves into Thai politics. And they came into power in 2019. And they've been in power since then, right? And over the last few years, people haven't been that happy. So it'll be interesting to see like what kind of divides and which way people vote for. You know, so it will be, yeah.
Do you think that legalizing marijuana will help them?
It's helping one of the parties. So that was legalized by the Bhumjathai party. And the party leader is Anutin. And he is one of the leading prime ministerial candidates. So he's looking to be a front runner. His party is looking to be one of the parties that will get like a lot of seats. So it is definitely helping.
How much credence do you give to the idea that viewing a country's marijuana laws is indicative of their wider society's overall freedom?
I mean, you could argue that Thailand is very free in a lot of things, right? But they were very strict about marijuana. And I feel that it's the same in Southeast Asia. Like, drug laws are very harsh in Southeast Asia, across the region. For some reason, like, Indonesia has killed Australian citizens for drugs, that Chappell Corby thing in the 2016s and all. Malaysia and Singapore also have crazy, like they're very strict with drugs. I'm not sure why it is in Southeast Asia, like, even for cannabis.
Yeah, but it's so weird with Thailand too, because I'm not sure if I remember this correctly, because I had a friend who was visiting there and they were talking about how, like, the weed laws between Cambodia and Thailand, and like I think Cambodia being really loose at the time, and then Thailand being fucked up. And just, it's interesting to me because Thailand is just like known as like, it's like the Beirut of Southeast Asia, you know, you go there to party.
Thailand has had a little bit of history of a war on drugs also. Like, in Southeast Asia, I feel like when governments in power, they try to, you know, blame something, they'll blame drugs, or, you know, instead of looking at themselves for society's whatever issues, or they don't, you know, so it's a very easy bogeyman, I feel. And like, that's why the Philippines has had a drug war, Thailand has had drug wars, like, and they'll kill people over suspicions of having drugs during these times, right? But at the same time, like, it's not like Thailand was so strict. Like, people were still growing weed anyway. You could still smoke around and all. It wasn't that it was being enforced so harshly everywhere. Like, it can be very localized in the setting too, if that makes sense.
Like, diplomacy in Thailand, is there any diplomatic factors that are going to be backing other parties? Like, is China a certain party and someone else another party?
Not that kind of thing that you'll see in like other countries, maybe like a Nepal or Sri Lanka or kind of place. It's pretty like Thai and independent. It's them after their own interests.
Okay, so how does that differ from Cambodia at all?
Cambodia is different because the elections are another one of those things where it doesn't matter. Like, the outcome has been decided. There's one opposition party. But they're not going to have many votes. The current PM, Prime Minister Hun Sen, he's been in power since, he's been Prime Minister since about 1985, if I remember correctly. And he's going to be the next Prime Minister. The only like thing that will be different, it might be his son, because he's priming his son up for to take over Hun Manet. So it's just that. So Thailand, you know, there is a choice, and you will have a dynamic elections. Cambodia is not that.
How is Cambodia, just in general, like society in Cambodia? Is it free? Is it not? How does the country operate? How do politics operate? What's the social fabric like?
Okay. So in terms of political expression, there's not. Yeah, like it's very low. So Hun Sen and his party have pretty much, his party's the Cambodian People's Party. It's dominated politics. And in the 2000s and 2010s, there were like these opposition parties that had kind of come together, and they were, you know, becoming a real challenge. But the leaders of those parties basically got arrested, or the parties were cracked down upon. When there were like protests in support of the parties, security forces would come beat people up, or, you know, tear gas them, that kind of thing. So political expression, there's none at all, pretty much. It's Hun Sen, he's dominated it. There, and even within his party, like there is a bit of, you know, infighting and, you know, different interests pulling at each other, but it's decentralized overall. So in terms of political space, there's not a lot. In terms of society, we're looking at a came out of a genocide and then just a very violent history. And even in the 90s, like just extreme poverty and all of that. So it is you know, developing along. And Hun Sen, like, there, one of the reasons he can claim like some level of legitimacy is because he has helped the economy grow over the last few years. In the last 20 years, he has brought some level of stability, and, you know, like, they are doing a lot in that sense. So I feel the contemporary Cambodia is very new because of its history and the Khmer Rouge, and then, you know, the genocide, and then all the political violence. It's still like coming along and finding itself out at this point. But yeah, politically nothing.
Are they still favorable to the idea of communism, or has that ship sailed?
That ship has sailed. You'll see that Hun Sen, he's actually gotten... So China is very close to Hun Sen and Cambodia, and they invest a lot over there. There's even allegations that he's allowed Chinese military forces to access a base in the country. Sorry, what was your question? I lost myself.
Whether they're still friendly with communists or communism.
I mean, they're friendly with China, but it's not a like communist kind of thing at all. Like, Hun Sen is very corrupt. He has enriched himself and his family in these last decades a lot. So it's not a communist kind of thing. The Khmer Rouge went really crazy with their, you know, try to make it an agrarian, self-sufficient.
But that's exactly what communism is.
But the thing is the Khmer Rouge actually, as far as percentage, because there's a lot smaller population here, but as far as the percentage of the population killed, it beats the Holocaust.
Yeah, a quarter of the population, right? According to some estimates.
Yeah. And like, it's insane. And like the things that you hear things like them like just bashing children against trees and things like that.
Yeah. And this really, like, they were, the Khmer Rouge came out in the like 1960s, and they were supported by the North Vietnam and China against the like Cambodia at that time. The U.S. was bombing, and there was like U.S. intervention, and the U.S. supported one government. So a bit of, you know, the Cold War thing was playing there. But the Khmer Rouge was only actually in power only from 1975 to 1979. Like, that's when they had absolute control. Like, and in those 4 years, killed, you know, like 2 million. Of the population, 2 million people, I think it was around that time.
It was 2.2, wasn't it?
Something like that, yeah. And yeah, just the killing fields of Cambodia, like, I think there's enough visual aids. And
yeah, I mean, bones still rise from the ground there.
Yeah.
Also, I think I'm pretty sure this is still the case, but Cambodia has more amputees among children than any other country because of all the undetonated bombs and landmines.
Yeah. And mining, demining, like, that's a national project. And they have to do it, you know. And it's really cool how they got rats. And rats have been helping, like, because they don't, like, blow up the mines when they get on it. And they can train them. So they've been using rats quite a lot. But, yeah, that is a massive problem. Just unexploded mines everywhere. Like, kids will still get injured playing in fields, you know. And there's a lot of places, like, that are marked off. Like, don't go here. We don't know whether there's mines or not. So, yeah.
In the general area of Southeast Asia. Not so much the island parts, because I know a little bit more about those ones, but this area in Southeast Asia, we're looking at any militancy, because, you know, you have Afghanistan and Pakistan right there. There's obviously militancy there, but how much of that spills over?
Okay, so Myanmar, you have militancy. Thailand, you have militancy in the Deep South, because there's a Malay Muslim, like, insurgency that's been there. I mean, Indonesia, you have militancy, right? Terrorism, and you have the Papuan separatists. The Philippines, the southern Philippines especially, you have the communist insurgency, and then you have the Islamist militants also. So there's quite, but in not anything in Cambodia or Vietnam, really.
But how about these guys right here, the Tamil Tigers? Didn't they used to be number one? How are they doing?
They were, I think the Tamil Tigers did the first suicide bombing in history, I think. And they killed the Indian Prime Minister, Rajiv Gandhi. But they've basically been defunct. They were, in 2009, the Sri Lankan Civil War ended. And like their leader, Prabhakaran, he was killed. And right now, like, there is a bit of a Tamil movement, but it's not the LTTE anymore.
Also in that area, Bangladesh. As far as I know, it's a dictatorship and the lady's going to stay in power.
Yeah, pretty much. So Bangladesh has gone between two people in the last 20 years. It's Khalida Zia, who has been the first prime minister, like in the contemporary area, since the 1990s. It's been Khalida Zia and Sheikh Hasina. Sheikh Hasina is the current prime minister. She's been the prime minister since 2009. Since the 1990s, it's basically just switched between Sheikh Hasina and Khalida Zia. Sheikh Hasina is the daughter of Bangladesh's founding father. Khalida Zia is the wife of one of Bangladesh's first presidents. So it's that political, you know, dynasty kind of thing. And right now, it's Sheikh Hasina. She will win the next elections. But it's interesting that Khalida Zia's party is, you know, getting some momentum back after a long time, because Hasina hasn't been doing that well. But in the last, like, 5-10 years, she's cracked down on dissent, on any political opposition, all of that, like, just holding on to her power more and more and getting more autocratic.
So, but the big thing there is slavery and the supply chain acts that need to happen. Like, there was the textile collapse.
The Rana
changed everything.
Rana building in 2014.
So I would say that's the more important thing about Bangladesh. I don't think anything's going to change there, but it's insanely important to the cotton industry, which ties back to, like, Uyghur genocide and things like that. So it's extremely important that we invest in this economic infrastructure for Bangladesh, because it quite literally will reduce genocide elsewhere. Uzbekistan has also started to outlaw slavery, which is the other big cotton producer. Bangladesh takes that raw cotton and makes textiles. They're basically the seamstress of the world. So it's extremely important that we protect the supply chains and make sure that they stay, like, genocide free and buildings don't collapse on people. And so it basically, the supply chain acts will make it so basically OSHA laws would apply to your companies that operate overseas. And you can't just move overseas, start a sweatshop and not have liability. They're not going to happen in America, but they've happened in Germany, I think, and they're moving through the EU.
What you were saying about the, you know, the garment industry. So the ready-made garment industry, like Sheikh Hasina, has really developed that, and that's become one of its biggest industries. And there's also a lot of problems apart from, you know, buildings falling down. Like, there'll be protests by workers all the time about, you know, not getting paid on time or like having months of outstanding. So there's a lot of labor.
It's one of those places where you show up and they'll pick you if they want to work. It's very exploitive. Nobody has a permanent work contract. It's day by day. So they get around so many of these things. And it's basically slavery there too, but there are actual slavery problems in the region.
Yeah. I mean, Bangladesh, that's where the Rohingya are settled, right? Fleeing from Myanmar, and that Cox's Bazar area, there's a lot of, like, even within the Rohingya camps, there's like militancy and a lot of crime, a lot of drugs and all of those things. And for Bangladesh, authorities are getting increasingly concerned that this is becoming a more and more security issue. So they're trying to put like all the Rohingya on this one island that's kind of off the coast and resettle them all there.
Okay, so on our list here, we have Nepal and then I think Maldives here.
Yeah.
You mentioned Nepal already. said something about it's basically just ridiculous sham elections.
Nepal, I'd mentioned in the context that, you know, there's more of an India-China thing there. It's not necessarily sham elections. Like, so Nepal had, it's going to have its presidential elections this year, but last year in November it had its general elections, and that was interesting because two rivals came together after a long time and formed a coalition. So this presidential election is a bit of a test for the new coalition, which is already, you know, in fighting, and one of the guys is seen as more pro-China. There's also a lot of different interests, and India also gets involved in this, and even after the November 2022 election, it took weeks to form a government. It's not going to be so stable. Like, I personally don't think the government is going to complete its term.
So do you mean that it won't even get to these elections that are supposed to be held in March?
It will get to these elections, but, you know, the outcome of this election could split the coalition further and, you know, fracture it more. And then at some point in the next, like, I don't know, maybe 1-2 years? Yeah, because the parties that came together, they had been rivals since the start, you know, pretty much. And it's right now they've kind of come together, but it doesn't look like it's going to last, you know. And Nepal has been one of the places that has suffered from, you know, a lack of governance, and that's led to, you know, India and China trying to have more of a foothold and all
that.
That's
what I was going to ask, is the border disputes and things like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's border disputes with India. There's issues with China also. India has been heavily involved in Nepal. They killed some of the monarchy and all, or I think maybe 20, 30 years ago. China also. So it's become a bit of a playground for the India-China thing, because if you look at the area around there, China is taking over the Arunachal area, and they have Tibet and Bhutan on the other side, right? So this whole mountain range, the Himalayas and the plateaus, that's where I think like one of the next, like, a big conflict could break out, like this India-China border issue.
Yeah, I mean, we just saw people beat to death with rebar clubs.
Yeah, that's because they're not allowed weapons, because we are two nuclear powers, and we have in the past, like, fought wars in 1965 or something. 1962, China invaded. Because, you know, so we don't escalate shit and start sending off bombs.
India is going to be very crucial if China decides to fuck around.
Yeah.
Because if China starts anything, they have three fronts immediately.
Yeah.
So, try it.
Oh, Maldives.
Yeah, that's what we have stuff to talk about. But before we get there, we have a few regions here. So there's this one, and then also this one. This is a very small image. I apologize. But this is the territories we're talking about combined. They're very important. And obviously China's territories. So, you know, we kind of have the wall here. You can see that the Philippines is part of it. So, and then, you know, it's this blockade that's going to be going on in this South China Sea. And what's important is that there's not only elections going on in Marshall Islands. So they are an independent country, but there's some stuff that goes on between them and the U.S. They used to be a territory. So them and Palau are negotiating their ties with America. This is important for America's reach into the Pacific Ocean. It's basically they're the front line right up into that Chinese territory. Both those islands are extremely important. And then another one of those islands that is in the Micronesian area is actually in our territories. And I think that's the Virgin Islands. So, yeah, so Micronesia is huge. We still have, so we're going to have that regardless. But both these states, they're very small. They voted to be independent from Micronesia. So they have contracts. And the big thing is that there was nuclear tests going on and they want more compensation for this. The U.S. has already given them $500 million, I think. We still haven't checked that. But basically, they want compensation for the nuclear tests, and climate change is ravaging these places. And this is one of those corridors where China could scooch in and gain something on that important front that would basically make a deadlock there and make sure war doesn't happen there. So it's a nice little competition going on down there. That's going to be very important how these deals play out. So, and then we also have this country with the ugly flag we haven't talked about.
Oh yeah, the Maldives. They also have the elections. This one is going to be interesting. So Maldives is another place where, you know, India and China have been playing out their little rivalry for decades. Right now, the big thing for the current elections is within the ruling party. The current president is fighting against someone from his own party, and that's going to split the ruling party. The MDP is the party, the Maldivian Democratic Party. It's going to be a presidential election. It's Ibrahim Mohamed Soli versus Mohamed Nasheed, and they're from the same party, and that's causing a lot of problems. And Maldives, you do get a bit of political violence and like some clashes and stuff. And of course, India and China. Soli is considered closer to India. Like, India likes having Soli around over there. So let's see how it turns out.
Okay. I think we hit pretty much everything. There's just some minor elections, like minor elections in India, the Philippines. And that's about it. But, you know, it's just with India, though, when is the next big election there?
Next year.
Because that's a very important global election that will affect global stability. Modi is apparently the most popular politician in the world.
He's going to win the next election, too.
No contest.
Not really.
Yeah, just wipe the floor. That's what I assumed.
Well, what's another election that's happening soon?
Basically, those are the big ones. Is Turkey is probably the biggest one.
And Nigeria. Is Erdogan going to lose?
Yeah, Nigeria as well. Erdogan can lose. That's what's important.
Interesting. Okay.
Can lose. It would be very good. I think that he is going to use the earthquake to his political advantage. And that's going to be a very determined factor going into it. What I want to wrap with is the greater outlook picture of global powers in the region. We obviously have India and China there, but we also have Australia and the U.S. and even Japan and Korea sometimes get involved. So are any of these elections potentially going to shift the global politics going on between nations?
Pakistan. I mean, Pakistan, just for the sake of itself, will affect global politics, even if it's just an internal thing, you know? seeing the terrorism and instability that's coming out of there. Yeah, Bangladesh, I mean, in not really that much. Thailand. So over the last like 2 decades, while the US and the West didn't pay that much attention to Southeast Asia, China really came in. And if you'll see that, you know, China's biggest trading partners for nearly every Southeast Asian country and a lot of these, even the Pacific countries. So now you're seeing like the US try to come back in Southeast Asia too, but it's not so easy. Considering like China's replaced them in a lot of aspects, like China is helping them build a lot of infrastructure in these countries. And,
the U.S. also wanted nothing to do with that place after like the Cold War, including Afghanistan. You know,
yeah.
Like when the '90s hit, they're like, "Please get out of here." And we also had the expansion of NATO going on at the time, so there's mostly European investment going on with the U.S. And then after that, it was the War on Terror, where we have our primary focus being on the Middle East and not really going into Southeast Asia. Yeah. So I think. That has really, had an advantage on some of our opposition. But there's also no real reason besides China for the U.S. to care about that region.
In terms of resources and like money and stuff.
Yeah, of course.
A lot of, you know, like a lot of American corporations, oil and gas, like Western companies pretty much. It's Western companies and Chinese companies that are, you know, trying to operate all the fields themselves through different countries or subsidiaries.
Who's going to be an upcoming big player, in your opinion?
In terms of
geopolitics.
I think Indonesia.
I agree. Yeah. Indonesia is extremely important. And also, I think they have, I think their military is actually underrated and it's extremely big. Like,
It's also not that modernized. So that's what we're seeing in the South China Sea is Indonesia spending a lot of money now, building up military, building up its navy, building up bases around the Natunas, where, you know, Chinese vessels come in and they'll like ram Indonesian fishermen or like enter like within 12 nautical miles off Indonesian territory, which is illegal. So like Chinese Coast Guard vessels come harass Indonesian vessels and they'll go around like resource projects and just do their own surveys and that kind of thing. So the securitization of the South China Sea, that's really been happening. We've heard about China's side, but you know, like Vietnam is also doing that, strengthening its naval.
That's what I was just about to say, is Japan is helping Vietnam build the navy.
Yeah, so these are all against, you know, like China's maritime militias and, you know, China's aggression in the South China Sea. And even the new Filipino President Marcos, he's not as...
There's a history with that family.
There is a history with that family, but so far what he's not trying to depend on... He's not trying to say, like Duterte, the former president, said that, you know, there's no point fighting against China, so fuck it. He recently did allow the U.S. more access to bases in the Philippines. So U.S. troops can use more bases there and they can build some infrastructure there too. So he's also looking, like, everyone's looking at this from, like, the West and China, and they're trying to gauge and balance where they are, right? But that being said, no one wants to be on either side because they want to hedge their bets and, like, you know.
There's also a big economic pact that China ran. Wasn't there like it was one of the biggest economic cooperation deals where they all came together in that region? And it was like, well, I don't remember much about it, but do you know what I'm talking about?
Vaguely, not off the top of my head, but yeah, there are a lot of these, like
it was like a NAFTA thing, you know?
Yeah, free trade agreements and all of that. So there's a lot of these regional things also. Even ASEAN has one within itself, you know? And the idea is to eventually be like Europe, but it that's not feasible in terms of, yeah.
Why is it not feasible?
I mean, the European system where, you know, it's open market and borders and stuff. Like, firstly, all the countries are not geographically connected. But, like, so there's each country has too many of its own dynamics to... Like, no country will open its borders like that, you know, and just let the free movement of trade and goods, especially as we're getting more concerned about security and, you know, these kind of things. So and you see even Europe, right? It's I don't know, but from what I understand, like, people are dialing back on the whole togetherness kind of thing. And
yeah. I mean, the fascist coalitions put a big dent in it before. But to wrap up and ask a final question is, why should the West, you know, as in Westerners who are listening to this, why should they care about these regions?
Oh, because America, for some reason, and the West, for some reason, decides to intervene and, like, do a lot over here. So it's good to know about what you're doing. But it's also, like, I don't know, just the whole world, you know, U.S., China.
Yeah, it's good if you're a commie, you know, it's good to know, because then you can talk shit about the things America does and talk about how China's great. So
yeah, you can go the other way. Also, you could, like,
I
just
do,
China.
I do love genocidal ethnostates. So great.
Yeah, there's a lot of violence in Southeast Asia and South Asia, so. Yeah. That's always of interest.
All right, so let's end it there.